Hello, and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. We also welcome our listening audience, and we invite everyone to visit us online at commonwealthclub.org. I'm Ann W. Smith, co-chair of the club's Arts Forum, and your program organizer for today. It's time to introduce our speaker for today, the opening of the August Platform Symposium, Music Matters. And he is our jazz hero, Sonny Buxton, broadcaster, musician, impresario, and educator. In terms of today's talk, Sonny will consider how music matters in terms of jazz, civil rights links, and mirrors. His many experiences incorporate remarkable references from Armstrong to Coltrane and Davis that resonate with music and civil rights today. Sonny is well known in the local jazz community for decades. He's been a beacon for jazz since arriving in the Bay Area in the 60s. He's a seasoned broadcast journalist who worked as a reporter and talk show host for KGO TV and radio in the 70s. The Seattle-born nightclub impresario and jazz DJ has kept quality jazz alive in San Francisco, presenting artists from the Bay Area and out-of-towners alike in his club's Milestones and Jazz at Pearls. Since Pearls closing in 2003, through his radio work at KCSM, and his conversations with Sonny in various venues throughout the year. He's worked as an accomplished professional musician, congas and trap drums, with the likes of Peggy Lee, Billy Eckstein, and Bill Strayhorn. He's produced shows ranging in scope from the Motown All-Stars to B.B. King, Ray Charles, Ella Fitzgerald, and Miles Davis. He traveled with Ellington, producing an award-winning audio documentary. A Northern California Emmy awardee and master storyteller, Sonny continues to enlighten music fans. You can hear him midday Saturdays at KCSM. This program, by the way, is part of the 2015 series sponsored by Ernst & Young and the John and Marcia Goldman Foundation. Without further ado, Sonny Buxton. Yes.
Thank you, Ann. Thank you. And good afternoon to all of you. Well, as Ann mentioned, I love to tell stories, so I'm going to lead off with a story. And this is a mythical story, but it's still a story, and I think it gets to a point that we're going to try to make this afternoon. There was a small man, a fellow out of New York, and his aim was to be the world's greatest violinist. Not necessarily jazz, but just the world's greatest violinist. So he set out to do just that. He got all the proper education, and everyone marveled at this guy's prowess. They said, man, you're really something. So he wowed everybody. He got all the critics in line, and everybody lined up behind this guy and said, he's wonderful. He's the greatest thing that's ever happened to the violin. And he performed in concerts all over the world, just doing everything. And then suddenly he woke up one day, and he discovered that he was bored. He'd done it all. He said, I've mastered everything that I set out to do. Now I'm bored. So what? Now what? And he wasn't really that old, so he said, I know what. I got the key. I'm going to take my music to the animals. So that's what he set out to do. He starts going around the world performing to the animals. So one time he's out in the middle of the jungle, and he finds this clearing, and all these animals, the giraffes, the lions, the chipmunks, everybody, they're all sitting around listening. They're in awe. And this little guy's playing, he's just playing his heart out, you know. And so, this is the guy that always put everything he had into his music, everything. So he didn't pull back with the animals, and the animals are just sitting there, and as I said, they're in awe, and they're listening to this little man playing this violin. And all of a sudden, this panther comes around the corner, around this tree, sees all these animals, the lion, the giraffes, and all of them are sitting out there listening to this little guy playing this instrument. And he walks right past them, jumps on this little guy, smacks him down, starts eating him, eats the violin, and he finishes, And he's walking back to where he came from, and this lion says, "Oh, man, what'd you do that for?" And the guy says, "Huh?" He couldn't hear. He couldn't hear. He didn't know what he had done. This is a point that I'm going to make, I hope. Because when we're talking about jazz, frequently I think people just can't hear. They're not bothering to listen. They see that word, J-E-Z, and they get wound up about it. If you pause for a moment to listen, something might come through. Just might happen. Now, in the case of Duke Ellington, I remember people were critical of him because he did not participate in the civil rights marches. And someone finally confronted him with this, says, "Well, you know, some people think that you're not really doing a Duke. You're not out there marching. Lita Horne's out there marching. Sidney Poitier, Harry Belafonte. No Duke." He said, "Well, those are people who have not been listening to our music." And he made a point. And he always identified what we call jazz as the African-American classic. Duke Ellington sort of put it on the line in 1941 when he produced this show called Jump for Joy. He was one of the producers, but it was all his music. And people like John Garfield and some of the liberal Hollywood people came in. John Garfield, Lana Turner, Mickey Rooney, they invested in it. So it ran for about 3 months. And as Duke said, when people were asking him to describe what this musical was about, he says, "Well, we're putting Uncle Tom to rest forever." That was the idea. And it was controversial, you know, but controversial on a lot of different levels, because during those years, 1941, all the critics were white. So it was not a wise thing for a black man to stand up and say something like putting Uncle Tom to rest. Who the hell do you think you are? Well, that's what Duke said. So in 1943, Duke Ellington goes to Carnegie Hall to do a production called Black, Brown, and Beige. It's an extended work, the first extended work that a black man had done in a place like Carnegie Hall. And once again, the white critics were not very kind because this guy was arrogant. Who the hell does he think he is? He's a dance band director. He's supposed to be making people dance. He's not making a statement. He's making a statement. Black, Brown, and Beige, who the hell is he? So Duke shelved that for a long time, but it was a very important statement, and it was ahead of time, ahead of his time, ahead of our time. So if you want to look into the mirror of jazz, I think, especially in civil rights, you can find a path. You can find a path that, in many cases, sort of ahead of the curve. And it's been that way since the turn of the century, turn of the last century. Louis Armstrong made a recording in 1929. The opening stanza was, "My only sin is the color of my skin. What makes me so black and blue?" So that's a pretty strong statement, right? Especially coming from someone like Louis Armstrong, who, by the way, as a youngster, I could not stand. In his early years of television, Armstrong was always on television and the Ed Sullivan Show and so on. All I could think of, I saw that handkerchief and I wanted to turn away. I didn't get it. I just didn't get it. And then when I was getting a little older, I went to see Lionel Hampton one evening with some friends of mine. And my jazz guru was a Japanese friend of mine. And so this was the Lionel Hampton band that had a young Clifford Brown, strong trumpet player. Quincy Jones was in the band in the trumpet section. So we're all there to hear these guys. And it's just an outstanding group of talent. And so the whole show was Lionel Hampton. Lionel Hampton jumped off of the piano and did the splits on the floor. He played the drums. He played the piano. And so when the show was over, I was in the parking lot. I wanted to get my car, so I'm 16 years old. I'm stomping. Just stomping. I was, what happened? We didn't see or hear any of these guys. And my friend, he patted me on the shoulder. He said, "Sonny, calm down." He said, "That's the way it is." He said, if Hampton did it the way you want it done, he wouldn't make a nickel. You know? And it embedded something in my head. They said, but he's doing it. He's out there. He's working. And that's pretty important. Lionel Hampton was the second black musician that Benny Goodman hired. Benny Goodman hired the first one in 1935. That was certainly ahead of the curve. That was Teddy Wilson, the piano player, in 1935. And it was a link between Jews and blacks that was very consistent. So it was not that unusual among the musician circles to see Benny Goodman hiring someone black, but to society, it was really unusual. That was pretty nervy. That was beyond being nervy. As big as Benny Goodman was, that was taking a big chunk out of it. He didn't have to go that way. But he hired Teddy Wilson, 1935, 1936, Langhampton, and then 2 years later, he's got Charlie Christian in the group. This is a small group, but nevertheless, it was a racially integrated group, and that didn't happen. A couple of years after that, Tommy Dorsey hired Cy Oliver. In my household, he was always known as Uncle Cy. He was a very close friend of Noble Sissel, who was my uncle. And so they would come to the house periodically, and I couldn't wait for those guys to come to the house. They had great stories. They were traveling around. They went to Europe, and they were coming back from London one time. I remember that. And as soon as they would come in the house, I was sitting right at their knees. I wanted to hear it, and they were sharp. These guys dressed, and it was showbiz. Noble Sissel, if you don't know that name, was part of the team, the Sissel and Blake. They did the first African-American produced and all black cast on Broadway. And that was in 1929, way back. So they were leading the way, and they had a ballad in that production, by the way. And we were not supposed to do ballads. We were not supposed to do love songs. Sounds pretty well out today, doesn't it? But they had a ballad in that production, and they were very, I remember Uncle Noble was talking about that. He said, man, we were scared to death. We had written it. We had decided among ourselves in the dressing rooms and rehearsals, we were going to do that ballad. We were going to do that love song. And then he said, the night that the opening show comes along, and he said, we had second thoughts. Should we do this love song? Should we not do the love song? They decided to go ahead with what they had already decided to do and produce this love song. So they did it. And they said, when they finished, everything got very quiet. And they said, uh-oh, we have really messed up. And then suddenly this applause broke out, and they said, okay, we have arrived. We can keep this in there. That production was called Shuffle Along, by the way, and it remained in production for quite some time, well into the mid-1930s, early 1940s. But that was a first. It was different. So you had Louis Armstrong doing a protest song of all people. Louis Armstrong doing a protest song. Well, he did. Black and Blue was a protest song. We had protest songs like Strange Fruit. A Jewish man wrote that tune. That was Abel Mirapol. He was a Jewish high school teacher in New York. He wrote the tune. And then Billie Holiday, he presented it to Billie Holiday, as a matter of fact, and Billie Holiday was working for a fellow named Barney Josephson, who owned a club in New York called Cafe Society. And it was a parody of all the other clubs in and around New York at the time. That existed. He had a fellow out front, as a matter of fact, as a doorman, who had a tattered top hat that he wore. He had holes in his tails that he and shoes like a clown. And it was the first racially integrated nightclub in New York City. So 1939, he hires Billie Holiday. And Billie Holiday wants to do this tune, Strange Fruit. Well, Strange Fruit was a story of a lynching based upon a photo, a 1930 photo of some black men who were lynched in Mississippi. And this photo just went all around the world, as a matter of fact. It was embarrassing. It should have been embarrassing. It should have been more embarrassing. And it was a photo that was used, too, to try to force some federal legislation, anti-lynching laws, which were never enforced, by the way. Never passed, and it's therefore never enforced. So there's Billie Holiday performing this tune, Strange Fruit, that's based upon the story of a lynching. A lot of people didn't like it. Barney Josephson didn't care. In fact, he defied anyone to say anything when Billie Holiday was performing the tune. They turned down all the lights. They had one small spot on her. She closed her eyes, and she would start singing this tune, Strange Fruit. If you haven't heard that tune, you owe it to yourself to stop and listen to it. It's been recorded so many times, covered more than 2,500 times since her first recording. Some of the rap artists have used it. It's still a very strong, strong piece. And so there was Billie Holiday, and I think to this day, as a matter of fact, looking back upon the career and the life of Billie Holiday, she suffered a lot. She had abused herself with drugs, and then she died at the age of 44, which is really young, and was arrested on her deathbed, as a matter of fact, because of possession of drugs in her purse. But I think that her performance, A Strange Fruit, and the attitude that some people like Marty Josephson had, which was demanding respect, began to haunt her. I think a lot of people thought, well, she's overstepped her bounds. You can't do things like that. What the hell, what's going on here? And something that I began to witness as time went on, and when I first heard jazz, really listened to it, I was enamored. I thought, my God, there's nothing more exciting than this music. The improvisation, the pure spirit of the music, it's just wonderful. And I didn't think too much about the social attitude that people might have about jazz until I moved to Los Angeles and I saw it firsthand. And I used to see the police come into the clubs where there were black and white people. We used to call them salt and pepper clubs. And the police would pull the white girls aside and ask them if their parents knew that they were in their club, especially if it happened to be a club that was in the black area around Central Area. And they would try their best to intimidate them. They would push some of the musicians aside. A fellow who lived here for a number of years, Frank Morgan, was a fairly well-known drug user, but he hadn't been arrested yet. And I saw him one evening pulled off of the stage right in front of everyone. The police made this guy take off his jacket, roll up his sleeve. This is in front of everybody. It didn't happen that way. And fortunately, the guy was clean, but nothing happened. I thought, now, what a way to tear someone down. But nevertheless, it also forced an issue. So some people were very defiant about it. When the newer music that was identified as bebop came along, that was defiant. It was very defiant. People today say, I don't like Miles Davis because he turned his back on the audience. Well, so what if he did? He was a brilliant player, and did he really have to stand there and grin to make people accept him? Armstrong did that, but did Miles have to do it? No one else really has to do it that way. And sometimes I would look at Miles when he was on stage and say, well, you know, not too much personality there. But he was playing very well, the hell of a band. And the music was identified as being defiant music. It was music that was ahead of the curve. A lot of the people who had been involved with swing didn't like the turn of events. It was time for a change. Swing music, which was jazz of the era, had been around for more than 20 years by the time the change came. And the change came from young, brilliant musicians who knew their craft, and they were working on something that was different, something that was new, something that was very inventive, something very soulful. And oddly enough, the first fan base for that new music was a group of white people. They were mostly young, white college students that were gravitating toward this music. So most cities weren't ready for a social change yet. Even if they were thinking about it, that the plan was not going to be thrust into their faces, but it was being thrust into their faces, and that's what I saw in Los Angeles. I enjoyed most of the music that I was hearing, what I would call the straight-ahead music. But the police were pushing as much as they could. Obviously, the directive was coming from City Hall, and they were not going to tolerate that. A very similar thing was happening in New York. It was happening all over the country, wherever there was this forced integration. So the integration was happening revolving around the music. It was revolving around the music. I was naive, I suppose. In fact, not suppose, I was. coming out of Seattle, I would paint a little mustache on my face. And so sometimes if some of the older guys recognized me and knew me, they would sort of sneak me into the Black Musicians Union. We used to have two unions. In all the cities, they had a White Musicians Union and a Black Musicians Union. So the Black Musicians Union halls in most cities was where most of the great musical activity was. They would have great jam sessions there. So Seattle was no exception. And so I would go into that jam session. I would see all kinds of different people. There were Filipinos and there were Japanese people. There were blacks, there were whites. Everybody was seemingly getting along very well together. And I thought, naively, as I said, that's the way it is. It's about the music. And it never occurred to me that there was something else going on until I moved, until I saw that debacle in Los Angeles and what a mess it was. Going back to the protest songs again, after Strange Fruit, remember the bombing in 1963 in Birmingham, Alabama, the 16th Street Baptist Church. Four young African-American girls, ages 11 to 14, were killed. Dynamite was planted by some white supremacists. Terrible story. and reminds me of some things that happened recently. But that was 1963. So Martin Luther King Jr. did the eulogy. Based upon his eulogy, John Coltrane wrote a tune called Alabama. Very powerful piece, extremely powerful. And that was a protest song. It was a protest song. And a lot of people gravitated toward that. This is a little different than We Shall Overcome, but you can put that in the same arena. And people were doing protest songs over and over again because things weren't quite right on a social level in this country. So many jazz musicians were doing as much as they could. Marvin Gaye did a protest on What's Going On. I think that was more of a jazz arena. It's still one of my favorites. But that was an anti-war statement. And so the We Shall Overcome, Pete Seeger, maybe Joan Baez, performing that before 300,000 people in the March in Washington in 1963. So all this was just sort of in a circular motion. People were making statements. Max Roach, Sonny Rollins, the Freedom Now Suite was a big deal. Difficult for those people to get those things recorded, but they did it, and they were making statements. They were making statements ahead of what was going on from coming out of Washington, certainly ahead of what was going on in most municipal areas. And jazz, in a sense, was always leading the way. And so my eyes were beginning to open up, fortunately, when I saw this stuff in Los Angeles. I didn't like it. I didn't like it one bit, so I was opening my mouth an awful lot about this, and not that I was out front. I was too young, too dumb to be out front. But I was trying to be a drummer, and I wanted to be around the scene as much as I could, possibly could. But you were always a bit on edge. I remember getting a job. The only job, the real job that I got, was a Wednesday night working at a place called the California Club. And the guy told me, he said, when you leave there, number one, don't ever leave there with a white woman. Don't do it. And secondly, don't let your car turn to the right, because you're going into the wrong neighborhood. He said, so when you come out, these guys were talking, he said, make sure you make a left-hand turn, come back down toward the we didn't say the hood in those days, but that's what they meant. So don't be tempted. And the first week that I was working there, so I'm unloading my drums, loading the drums into the car, and the police come up. And so, what are you doing? I said, this is my drums here, my drum case, I'm putting them in the car. And this guy stood there and he looked at me, kept looking at me, and I said, these are drums. These are drums. I said, I'm just putting them in the car, get out of here. So they were right. It's just be aware, be on cue about this stuff. And then there was constant pressure to do that. New York City had something that they called the cabaret card. And that remained in existence for about 37 years. Most black musicians felt that was something that was aimed directly at them. Because if you didn't have a cabaret card, you could not work in a place that served alcoholic beverage. Well, that's your lifeblood. If you can't work in a nightclub, you can't do it without a cabaret card. So many, many people were victims of that cabaret card. Billie Holiday, for one, she served her time. But still, she could not get a cabaret card to work in New York City. She could not do it. She didn't get one for the remainder of her life. When she died, she still hadn't received a cabaret card after her incarceration. Just couldn't get it. A number of other musicians were victimized that way, but there was a push. There was a big push to eradicate things like the cabaret card. And there was always doubt as to why the cabaret card existed. The police department administered the cabaret card. The proceeds went to the police fund, but it took a few people like Lord Buckley, for one, who was promised a cabaret card. He was a comedian, if you don't know that name, a brilliant comedian. I think head of Jonathan Winters, certainly head of Robin Williams, but he inspired a lot of those people. If you listen to them closely, you will hear Lord Buckley through and through. Very hip guy. And he had been asked when he first applied for a cabaret card if he had ever been arrested. Well, he had been, but he was cleared in Florida. And so they said, well, we asked you if you had been arrested, and you said no. Well, you really had. He said, well, no, it was a mistake. So they said, well, based upon that, we can't quite really grant you the cabaret card. Well, while he was awaiting this cabaret card, he died. Had a heart attack and died. And so that this prompted a lot of people to really start getting a bit closer to this cabaret card business. And finally, Frank Sinatra was going to be celebrated in New York City, coming back. I think they were doing the anniversary of his Paramount Theater days. And he brought up the issue. He said, you know that cabaret card? You know, maybe I won't come back to New York if you still have that cabaret card. Well, it was gone. It was over and done with. Similar thing happened in the 1960s with Sinatra's intervention. He wasn't the only one, but he finally put the cap on it. There was something called the Moulin Rouge Accord that was taking place in Las Vegas. The Moulin Rouge was a casino, a hotel, that opened in the black section of Las Vegas and only remained open for 6 months. Benny Carter and his orchestra were the opening act in the place, and just a fine, fine place. And a lot of the entertainers who worked on the strip, once they got off, would come out to the Moulin Rouge to perform free of charge. It was like an open jam session. And it was a salt and pepper place. Blacks and whites were all there alike. So mysteriously, after 6 months, the sheriff's department padlocks the Moulin Rouge. And that sort of ended it. But it was just a great, great thing. So in 1960, there was a push to start integrating the employees on the strip. So let's start getting some people in above and beyond the level of maids and janitors. Not only blacks, but Mexicans and so on. To get some dealers, bartenders, and waitresses. So they started this whole move from 1960. Well, even after the Civil Rights Act, Las Vegas still had not caved in. So finally, Frank Sinatra steps in and says, well, you know, this is going on. Howard Hughes was the last holdout. The deal was that all the casino operators, hotel operators, had to sign off 100%. Well, Howard Hughes was not going to do that. So when Sinatra steps in, he says, maybe I'll just start performing some other place. Done. So finally, we've got the places integrated in Las Vegas. And folks like Sonny could stay in the hotel where they worked. I worked there two different times with Peggy and was not able to live in the same place where I was working for that period of time. I mentioned that John Coltrane had done the protest tune Alabama. I first saw John Coltrane in person in San Francisco at a place called the Jazz Workshop, which was on Broadway. And I had never experienced an act as powerful as that, only four musicians, a saxophone, piano, bass, drums, and it shook me up. And I was sitting there, I was not only mesmerized, but there was something that was happening inside. I guess it was spiritual, I'm not quite sure, but whatever it was, I had never quite experienced that emotion in the past. And I remember at the end of the show, I thought, whoa, it's one of those things you think, you know, you get a little spooky, you know, you're not quite sure what had happened there, but these four musicians had generated something that was very powerful. And I went outside and I was leaning on this parking meter, you know, just trying to pull myself together. I knew better than to try to get in the car and drive away. And I turned around, and it was opening night, and there were a bunch of Bay Area musicians. I was standing there, and everybody had that sort of blank, strange look in their faces. I turned around and said, well, it's not only me. It was a pretty powerful experience. And, you know, there's a myth about all of us African Americans that we have a natural sense of rhythm. You've heard that story. You probably even passed it on yourself. Well, I'm here to tell you that it ain't true. When I was living down in Los Angeles, I was so enamored with this music, by the way, as I told you earlier on. But I was in love with a lot of different things. I was in love with the music, and I thought, I have to be a part of this music scene. I was in love with sports. I knew I had to be a part of that. I loved to read, so I was reading everything I could. Somehow or another, I thought, well, I have to fit all of this stuff in. I have to fit it all in. Well, I wanted to be a drummer, but I also wanted to be a lot of other things. Well, you have to devote yourself full time and give your whole heart to the music. I mean, you can't be a dilettante, not really. I'm hearing some people sometimes these days, and I think, well, I'm not sure that they're really that serious. But I wasn't serious enough, and I had a tendency to rush. I was always just ahead of the beat, just a little bit. You know? So one night, that job that I was telling you about, the Wednesday night job, I had him playing with the band, and Sonny Chris, who was a fine alto saxophonist, came to sit in. And I thought, boy, I was 18 or 19 years old. I thought it was just a year or two ago that I had all of his records. And so Sonny Chris gets on a bar stool, sits up on the stage, and
And we kick off a tune, and I'm so excited that the boys, I'm playing with Sonny Criss, I'm just playing. And so we ended the tune, and Sonny wheels around the bar stool. He says, that your kit, meaning the drum set? I said, yes, sir. He said, well, get your ass off the stage. I think, well, first of all, this is my gig. You're just sitting in. And he says, get your ass off the stage. And I thought, boy, and I think a lot of people heard it. He got a little loud with the second request. So, so I'm hurt. Tears are in my eyes. And then I'm walking off the stage. And Ornette Coleman lived in the neighborhood. And Ornette had been abused a lot because Ornette was very different. And so Ornette grabbed me by the arm. I didn't even see him. And he gestured for me to sit down with him. So I sat And he said, just calm down, calm down. So by this time, I wanted to go back up and punch Sonny Criss. So Ornette kept saying, calm down, calm down, calm down, calm down. So anyway, I sat down. I began to calm down a little bit, but I was still very embarrassed. So Ornette says, he says, you know what you need to do? I said, what's that? He said, go find yourself a church. I said, and pray for it? He said, no. He said, find yourself a good Pentecostal church, volunteer your services. He said, and give that about 6 months. He said, you'll come out like a metronome. So really. So anyway, I left. And I didn't go back to the job for 2 weeks. I was just humiliated, you know. But that was a part of it. I think that this guy may have recognized me as a dilettante drummer, which is what I was. And but anyway, I found a Pentecostal church in Long Beach, California. And went in, volunteered my services. Well, I was a Catholic. And so, I mean, this is a different scene altogether, you know. So my first time with it, Ornette said, look, he said, follow those sisters. He said, but those tambourines, he said, they'll be playing 6/8 time, 4/4, 3/4. They can't tell you what they're doing. He said, but you just follow whatever they're doing. So I'm set up, and so I worked once on Saturday, twice on Sunday at this Pentecostal church. And so my first weekend there, man, I mean, the service gets going. I mean, this stuff is kind of lifting up off the floor, you know. And these sisters, you know, all kind of large women, and they had the white kind of nurses-looking outfits on. This one kept walking up and down the aisle, and she was wringing her hands, and had this wild look, you know, and there was no place for me to go. I'm back up against the wall with these drums, you know, and I took a oh, man, you know, and I said, I hope she doesn't come my way, you know. So, and then finally, it's like she started looking at me. I could see this fire coming out of her eyes, and she's looking right at Sonny. And I thought, oh, you know. Anyway. I survived. I got out of the church unscathed. And believe me, Ornette was correct. You play with those sisters, man, they get that rhythm going on those tambourines. And it was true. It took about 4 months of doing that. And I don't care what tempo people counted off or how they did it, I was right with them and got on with it. Pretty important stuff. And this is all a part of the foundation, by the way. Those Pentecostal churches, it's the spirituals, the blues. All of it is very, very important, extremely important, and that's what I was beginning to discover as I was stepping out there. That these different little areas, different things, different places, how important it all is, and also it's a never-ending odyssey. You're never going to pick it all up. As I said, I was a dilettante drummer. I had to be a dilettante drummer because I was busy doing a lot of other things. And I think many musicians caught on to that. A lot of the old guys, they really paid some pretty heavy dues to get to that level. People were being pushed off of bandstands, being attacked as they were leaving clubs because the music was wrong as far as they were concerned, or they were walking out with the wrong color person. It was treacherous. But yet these people prevailed. They pushed. It was very, very important. So here comes a young college guy. Sort of, I don't know if I looked like I was messing around. I was pretty serious about the music, but maybe I wasn't serious enough, and I certainly didn't know enough. I didn't know anything, really. I'm still learning. So I didn't know anything in those days. I was working with one guy, I remember, and he had hired a bunch of young people. And so every night we would get off this gig. I think we'd work 3 nights a week. And we'd have to go to this coffee shop, and he would grill us. And he would start asking about, do you know this tune? Do you know that tune? Do you know the lyrics to this tune? And I said, man, is it ever going to end? Did it ever quit? And you get a little spooked about it. I thought, there are thousands of tunes out there, thousands of them. And it's not only the Gershwin tunes, it's the other tunes, all those other things, you know. And especially when he started breaking it down to lyrics, is this guy said, he said, well, if you're a horn player, he said, I'm not a horn player. He said, but you mess around singing. I said, I only have about 20 tunes I sing. So he said, but you need to know the lyrics. He said, even as a drummer. He said, if you're going to get the right feeling in there, you know the whole thing. He says, not just the melody line. He says, it's a feeling. He said, people in the audience know that they're waiting for it. They know those lyrics. They know the lyrics. Is this about time for me to?
No.
Oh, I'm okay? Okay, you're going to give me some signals, right? Okay, good. So anyway, that's an important element, and also most of those people that we're talking about have come through all of that at one time or another. If you listen to the great saxophonists in particular, when they play the ballad, you could tell they knew the lyrics, they knew the story. The story was important, and this story is still important today. And I think it's also important to just to talking about the history of this music, the history of jazz, to know the storyline. Know what these people were up to. We talk about Bach, Beethoven, Brahms, Chopin, Debussy. Well, there's some of the other names that are very, very important. They may sound for like funny names to you, Thelonious Sphere, Monk, but a pretty important figure. Pretty important figure in all this great American classic. Miles Davis, Charlie Parker, Louis Armstrong. Louis Armstrong, by the way, as I mentioned, I said I had so much trouble keeping up with him and trying to figure out what the hell this guy was doing early on. And it was many years before I really stopped and listened to Louis Armstrong because I was so caught up with his public image. Louis Armstrong was about 10 light years ahead of everybody else. How would you feel today if you heard someone say that they discovered a lost manuscript of a concerto done by Louis Armstrong? Would you chuckle? I think a lot of people would. He was married to a lady who was certainly capable of doing that, probably had written that. Lou Hardin was her name, his second wife. But it was almost an impossibility during that time that Armstrong was coming up. But I bet that they had a desire to do it. Why wouldn't they? I mean, he was the world's greatest trumpet player, by none. Way ahead of the curve. But then there were obstacles. There were strange obstacles that never should have existed. Never should have existed. And there's still obstacles today. Some people just can't seem to get past it. Can't get past it. I mentioned the Bees, the Brahms and Beethovens and so on, Chopin. And then we get to these other names that some people refuse to take seriously for some strange reason. And the names can't be the true obstacle. And also many people say, well, I never stopped to listen to that music. Why not? Why not? Why would you not stop to listen to it? I mean, it's right there, it's right in front of you all the time, you know, so pause for just a few minutes, stop and listen to it. Also, I mentioned to people when I'm talking with younger people, I said, there's a lot of jazz that I don't like, so I don't bother. I do a once-a-week radio program, and I thought, well, I'm in here for 4 hours, and I'm not going to play anything I don't like. I'm just not going to do it. So it would be different, I guess, if I was there for 20 hours a week, but I'm there for 4 hours, so I just don't play music that I don't like, and I don't have to like it all. I don't have to like all the people who have participated in this music. So that should not be an obstacle. I used to take a lot of taxis around San Francisco, so frequently I would get in the taxi cabs during the radio days, and with K-Jazz especially. So a lot of the guys said, okay, K-Jazz, and I said, do you ever go to clubs? And some guys said, I'm getting ready, I'm not quite ready. So what do you mean you're not ready? just go in, sit down, listen to the music. You don't have to know all the ins and outs. You know, if it makes your booties kind of shake a little bit, then go out and enjoy it. just enjoy it. And if you decide to really get into a complete clinical study of it, then do it that way. You know, but don't hesitate going out to hear the music. But we have drawn the line in this country. We've drawn a pretty solid line about this. And yes, it does matter. The jazz matters, and it matters quite a bit. So I'm gonna pass it on to you guys now. And thank you, Ann. Thank you.
Well, we have some questions, so we'll begin. And we'd like to remind our listening audience that this is an arts forum program of the Commonwealth Club of California, and you are listening to Speaker Sonny Buxton. I have a question here. One is about, you know, it's really wonderful to hear you at the public forum of the Commonwealth Club. And where else have you spoken to spread the word? And where have you had any particular adventures with trying to talk to people about what the jazz story is?
I wouldn't call it an adventure, but that's an interesting word to use, and you're probably correct. Wherever I can, and I don't consider myself as being a preacher doing this. I think the best thing that happened was operating nightclubs and presenting the music. I mean, just there's no better example than just simply being able to put it on stage and have people listen to it and going from there.
Does it matter where it is?
And I do the radio program, and that's it. I don't really have to talk about it.
Are some places quieter than others, more attentive?
Yeah, some places are quieter. I was always very insistent upon that, to a point where a lot of people joke about it to this day, you know, that I really want people to sit down and listen to music. And I was always insistent upon that. I don't like a lot of bottles rattling and people chatting. And I remember one night some guys came in, they were singing their college frat song, and so I put them all out. But I just think that's a total lack of respect for the music, for me, for the venue, and everything else.
Here's a question you've probably heard before, maybe a decade or so ago, or more. Is there a new generation of musicians keeping jazz alive? And is the music business killing jazz?
Killing jazz?
Mm-hmm.
The first one, yes, so there's a whole new generation. Jazz studies is one of the most popular subjects in all the major universities and colleges today. I don't think you can find a major university that does not offer a jazz studies course. They're expensive. So that makes my antenna go up a little bit. I love the idea that the music is being explored, but is it becoming exclusive? It's not for the average person, so I don't see it happening on the high school level, not nearly enough, and I would like to see it more often than that. The music business is just that. It's the show biz is just what that says, and it's always treacherous. It's a landmine, and it's very tricky, but you find most people doing their recordings independently these days and bypassing all that nonsense. So that in itself is pretty healthy, I believe.
Have there been instances where there was a genuine feeling that, hey, this is just killing the genre, you know, the business part?
I think the public is killing it with their lack of acceptance, lack of understanding. But it's almost a three or four pronged way of looking at it. You can look at it from the standpoint of the record business, but you can look at it from the standpoint of the radio business. Radio, of course, has to go for the juggler. They say they can't afford to put anything on that's not selling. So jazz represents about 3% of the commercial market, and that almost answers it right then and there.
From a radio perspective, how do you evaluate what's going on today with jazz on the radio?
Well, there is some jazz on the radio. We're one of, I guess, two full-time jazz stations in the country, so that there aren't many. There's a little bit of jazz out there. There needs to be more. I always say that. But if you look at the commercial end of it, I can understand that the people that are trying to make the cash register ring, it's not an easy sell. But maybe the schools. And I would love to see the high schools, as an example, at least start mentioning the name of Duke Ellington. Let's talk about Count Basie. Let's talk about Louis Armstrong. At least throw those names out there. Put the names in some books. And then it's more than embarrassing to talk with some young students today who have never heard the names. You can't blame them, but they've never heard the name, much less the music.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's, as a teacher, I sometimes am astonished by what students haven't heard of. You know, you don't know who Marvin Gaye was, or yeah. Bob Dylan, or John Lennon. Oh, let's see. This is relating, I guess, to the closing of Yoshi's. And are those clubs dying at the expense of performance venues that present music as a traditional kind of concert rather than as a, you know, complete supper, music, drinks experience?
Well, it's very expensive to operate those venues, and I'm a living example of that. It's hard. It's very difficult. I think that the story of Yoshi's is a compound story, and I think it was designed to fail. And when I say designed to fail, I mean architecturally it was designed to fail. If you stepped into that building, there was no way it was ever going to make it. I don't care what you put in there; it just wasn't going to make it. There's a lot of, but there are a lot of different angles in that. But I think it was architecturally designed to fail.
So that's
not going to be. People always say, as an example, and this is something that's a special irritation to me, you know, jazz doesn't work, but seldom, if ever, will people get into the root of it. Sometimes it's very poor ownership, very poor management, very poor thinking in the case of Yoshi's. That never made any sense. If you stepped in that building, it didn't make one bit of sense. It was never, I don't care what they put in there, it just wasn't going to work. But the music itself is what suffers, so that there's another jazz club, and went down the tube. Well, there was another reason for that place going down. They weren't doing much jazz anyway when they finished. But nevertheless, it had nothing to do with the music.
Good answer. Nothing to do with the music. Let's see. So, what do you love about jazz?
I knew this was going to be a slick one. What I love about jazz is what I love about music as a whole. But I'm partial to jazz, of course, and it's about people. When you hear the right jazz act, the right jazz solo, you know it. Even though you may not be able to define exactly what this musician is doing who's out front soloing, you do realize that there's some brilliance that's taking place. These people are composing right before your eyes, instantaneously. And I would put that next to Picasso or anything else in the world that is happening on a creative level. And it defies your imagination. And sometimes you hear a solo. As I said, even though you can't define it, you look around the audience, and everybody in the room is being moved.
Yes.
And that's pretty unusual. It's a great feeling. It's a great feeling as a musician when you're on stage, if you're the one that's putting that out. But if you're the recipient, as a member of the audience, it's another feeling that I guess it's very similar to that one that I mentioned of John Coltrane.
Mm-hmm.
Just being almost overwhelmed, you know. But there's another way. You look at some people, and they're moving around. They're just kind of twitching their behinds, and they're patting their feet, and they're snapping their fingers. That's one level. And then some other people are just right inside the stuff, and it's beautiful. It's nothing quite like it.
And is this a matter of this improvisational skill? Is this something you develop? Some people have it naturally.
No, you don't have improvisational skills naturally. It takes work. It takes work. Some people arrive at the end of it a little sooner than others. But yes, it takes a lot of work, lots of knowledge, and these are all. John Handy's in the room here today. There's a highly skilled musician, and he would be the first to say that didn't happen overnight.
First to say it wouldn't happen overnight. Did you have a question, John? For Sonny. Sure.
I'm going to do that again. I said, which do you prefer clubs and other things that, well, no, of course, let's say clubs. Where it's, I grew up, you know, it's 67 years for me as a professional player. And I've always resented playing in small clubs where the cigarettes almost kill me. Do you prefer clubs to concerts? concert halls. That's what I'm trying to say.
You know, just, it's two different things, John. By the way, I failed to mention that we have an SF Jazz Center here in San Francisco now. Something that we should all be very proud of. This is one of a kind, one of a kind. So that's a difference there. There are certain acts that I would prefer hearing in a club. I like the intimacy, for especially sometimes for trios, duos, trios. I love that intimacy. And today, you don't have all that smoke. I know what you're talking about in those old days. I had clubs where there was lots of smoking. I smoked in those clubs. I remember putting in a system when we opened Milestones. That thing was a very expensive system, and you hit a switch, and in 10 seconds that smoke was gone. And so people came in one night and said, "Every time I come in here, this place is so clean. Why isn't there some smoke hanging?" I said, "Well, I just put this $75,000 system in here." So you can't win. You really can't win. But I think that for certain acts that SF Jazz is perfect, and the other times, and I want to be in an intimate place. I want to be in a place that only seats 75 people. And of course, I know they're not making any money, but that's the way I want to hear it. So that's my answer. I hope that's satisfactory. It's not. Yes.
Who are the contemporary artists now, in your opinion?
Oh, I really can't answer that one. There are lots of young people who are coming up, and they all have something to say, something to offer. There are still some of the elder statesmen around. John is still very active. It depends upon the instrument. I like Kenny Barron as a piano player. I love Ahmad Jamal, still very active. And I hear some young guys every now and then that sort of turn me around. And I hear some young drummers. It's same thing. I have not been a fan of Wynton Marsalis as a jazz musician since his first foray into the scene. But today I listen to him, and I think technically I think he's wonderful. I can't knock him. It just doesn't grab me. That's all. And that's another part of this. When we start talking about the music, it's very subjective. And I think that we should all be aware of that. Just because I say that it doesn't grab me, it doesn't mean anything. I certainly can't question this guy's technical prowess on the instrument, his devotion to the craft, and so on. But he just doesn't do anything for me. And it doesn't matter. A love song is just that. You know, there was a period of time when African American musicians were not allowed to record love songs. The first two to break that barrier were Billy Eckstein and Nat King Cole. Remember that? Prior to that time, a black male performer could not record a love song. That didn't happen. So a love song is just that. It's about love. And
I think she was asking about the Cecil Blake. The one in there, the
tune? Well, that she was asking for the definition of a love song.
No, that song that you were referring.
Oh, that song. I can't think. I can't remember the title of the tune. I'm sorry. I forgot the title.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Okay. Thank you for the answer. Also.
Okay.
That was a good answer. Okay, so you had Sonny, I guess, and hopefully everyone has that opportunity to have at least one moment with music that totally moved you. That was the Coltrane experience.
Yes.
And what does that say about the power of music when something makes you stop?
Well, I that shows that the music is boundless. That's the way it is in my mind. It can reach into the soul, and that's what shook me, I think. I didn't expect that. And I heard a lot of music, and I enjoyed a lot of it. But there was something that was reaching inside me, and it was also bringing out some emotions that I didn't know that I had. that was the other part of that. And it shook me up. It shook me up.
That will shake you up. When you didn't know, oh, I could feel like that. Well, Sonny, thank you so much. Our thanks to Sonny Buxton.
Thank you, Ann. Thank all of you.
Bravo. We thank Sonny at True Beacon for Jazz for his enlightening presentation here today, opening the club's 2015 Platform Series music matters, and it sure does. We also thank our audiences here, thanks to all of you, as well as those listening to the recording of the program. And now, this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, commemorating its 112th year of enlightened discussion, is adjourned.